Let's kick off this week with a rock lyric. And the lyric is, "December clouds are now covering me." That's a line from one of my favorite bands in the 1990s, Collective Soul. Whatever happened to Collective Soul? And their hit single, December, because, you know, we're in the midst of another December. So you see how we connect things in the far middle right at the start. Hey, this is Nick DeOlias, and let's get right into it. Dedication for 82, episode 82. It's going to go to one of the greatest boxing matches ever, one that occurred in the year 1982. So in November of 82, Aaron Pryor defeated Alexis Arguello in what would later be called the fight of the decade, but I think it might have been the fight of the century, especially from a boxing purist perspective. So Pryor retained the WBA's World Junior Welterweight title with a 14th round TKO of Arguello, and it was billed as the Battle of the Champions by that super promoter, Bob Arum. The location of the fight was down in Miami in the Orange Bowl. Fighters were at 140 pounds, light welterweights, and they were at the prime of their Hall of Fame careers. They had some really interesting nicknames. Aaron Pryor was nicknamed the Hawk, and Alexis Arguello, he had an even more interesting nickname. It was El Flaco Explosivo, and that is, in English, the Explosive Thin Man. That's a cool nickname for a boxer. Pryor was from Cincinnati. Arguello was from Nicaragua, and Arguello already held title belts in three lighter weight classes. So he was looking to be the first in boxing history to add a fourth with a win in the prior bout at light welterweight. So he was basically moving up in weight class to take on Pryor. And this was during what I consider to be the true golden age of boxing. So besides these two greats, you had names like Sugar Ray Leonard, you had Tommy Hitman Hearns, don't forget about Marvelous Marvin Hagler. You had Roberto Manos de Pietras or Hands of Stone, Duran, and on the names went. It was just a great period. And Arguello and Pryor, they had completely different personas. So Arguello, he came across as more sophisticated, sort of soft-spoken, refined, what I would call sort of an international man of intrigue. Pryor, he was having none of that. His demeanor was straight up intimidator. And of course, when those two personalities clashed, something had to give. So both fighters, they gave and took punishment round after round. There was so much action and so many blows were landed by each that it's still debatable to this day how to score each round and in whose favor. So if you watch that bout twice over the course of, say, 2 days, you'll come up with a completely different scoring of who won which round and by how much. It's that sort of action-packed and close fought. And a big controversy later in the fight was Pryor's corner referencing and using a mysterious second water bottle that was allegedly mixed with something. Pryor, toward the end of that fight, started to really batter Arguello. And as I said, he TKO'd him in the 14th round, beat him pretty severely in the final seconds before the fight was stopped. But you know what? Arguello, he refused to go down, and he only collapsed after the fight was stopped. So Aaron Pryor won. He wasn't drug tested after the bout. That adds to the intrigue to this day. And nobody even today knows for sure what happened with that second water bottle. But boy, if you want to see boxing the way it was meant to be, give a watch to that 14-round epic 1982 bout of Pryor and Arguello. Ring Magazine, which is sort of that Bible of boxing, it ranks it as a top 10 all-time title fight. I think they're correct in doing so. Episode 82 goes to the year 82, a golden year in the golden age of boxing. Awesome stuff for sure. So now we're off and running, making our connections between different issues or dots in episode 82, like we do every episode of The Far Middle. We started, what, by talking about two arch rivals who squared off in that 1982 bout with Aaron Pryor and Alexis Arguello. Well, we have two national rivals to discuss next, and not in a boxing ring, but instead on the geopolitical map, in a corner of the world that sees quite a bit, certainly more than its fair share, of animosity and strife. Those nations are Israel and Lebanon, and that corner of the world, of course, is the Middle East. The two longtime rival nations, they share a border, but of course that border, it shifts and changes by the conflict, and those conflicts have raged through not just years, but decades, frankly, since the creation of the State of Israel itself in the late 1940s. Now, with all that bad blood, and with all that violent history between these two nations, you'd think it'd be nearly impossible to get anything done that's going to require cooperation or agreement between the two. And perhaps that would be true under normal times, but as we've seen, 2022 is anything but normal times. In future years, they might even be more chaotic and abnormal than 2022. So these trying times may create windows of opportunity for rivals or frankly, outright sworn enemies, to collaborate with one another and to find some common ground. That's exactly what's happening in the context of energy security and the states of Israel and Lebanon. These two rivals, they reached an important agreement recently, and the agreement settles a border dispute, not on land, but in this case offshore in the Mediterranean Sea. Now, why this border out in the Mediterranean is so important is that there are gigantic natural gas fields that have been discovered just offshore and across the different disputed lines. So Israel wants the Mediterranean line drawn further to the north so it can claim complete ownership of more of the natural gas fields, while Lebanon, of course, wants the line drawn further to the south so that it could do the same. And while the border dispute was going on, what happened? Energy scarcity has loomed its ugly head, along with energy inflation, because of climate and energy policies doing their intended things. And those policies, coupled with how they enable dictators like Putin to warmonger, they've created an acute energy crisis in Europe, meaning Europe is clamoring for any new supply of natural gas that it could get its hands on. And these gas fields in the Mediterranean Sea off the coast of Israel and Lebanon, they're just what the doctor ordered. So these two longtime rival nations, they're not going to let a good crisis go to waste. They're finding a way to split the border and develop the natural gas fields. Both nations will benefit. The supply of natural gas is going to grow, and the energy security of Europe is going to receive a much-needed shot in the arm. Now, what's interesting and ironic and maddening all at the same time about this situation, you've got the Biden administration, who is mediating the dispute between Israel and Lebanon. In other words, the Biden administration, while they are attacking and they're vilifying and suffocating domestic natural gas and oil and pipeline development here, they're working night and day to nurture natural gas and related infrastructure development beyond our borders in places like the Mediterranean Sea. It's just another example of how this administration, they're embracing the wrong ideology at the worst possible time, and then the policies that embody those ideologies are exposed domestically and they're contradicted internationally. It's what happens when environmental ideology runs into the energy realities of the modern world. And this discussion, in a way, leads us into our next connection to make, which is how I was reading recently, and this was probably back, oh, I'd say in mid-October, an article where the director of Britain's government communications headquarters, so I think I got that title right, which is effectively a spy chief in the UK for electronic intelligence, was saying that China's efforts to exert control over communications technology, whether it be internationally or inside China itself, it was threatening global security and freedom. Now, the spy chief was also discussing how China broadens the definition of national security in a way that now includes electronic technology, and that being the key springboard as to why he now views China's efforts in the electronic intelligence realm as a threat to national securities across the globe. So I read the article, and I had basically two thoughts. The first was that the spy chief in the UK was stating the obvious. Of course, China is looking to beef up its electronic surveillance prowess and wants to use it to strengthen its geopolitical standing at the expense of its adversaries and rivals. You don't have to be a spy chief to make that connection, certainly. But the second thought that I had was a little less obvious, perhaps. And that is how inconsistent the elite and expert classes are when it comes to judging China's strategic position and tactical maneuvers. And what I mean by that is that here in the case of electronic surveillance and intelligence, there's a clear connection that's being made between China's industrial and technological positioning and how that will run adverse to the interests of Western Republican democracies in the context of geopolitical stability, right? But then, right, when those same experts and elites, they assess what China's doing when it comes to the energy sector, namely how it's looking to control the supply and processing capacity for all the elements and materials and rare earths that are needed for things like wind turbines and solar panels and electric vehicle batteries, the expert class just shrugs its shoulders as if it's not a threat at all to be concerned with. And this is far from the reality, because as China looks to secure and place a stranglehold on supplies globally of these materials, and then at the same time, they look to develop the key manufacturing infrastructure to make the wind turbines and the solar panels and the electric vehicle batteries, it is definitely not in the context of trying to save the planet's atmosphere or trying to lower CO2 levels. Instead, it's very much in the context of placing China in a strategically dominant position when it comes to energy supply and energy infrastructure relative to that of places like Europe and the United States, and frankly, the rest of the world. So that strategic positioning when it comes to energy, it's just as threatening, and it has the same dangerous potential that China's strategic positioning in the arena of electronic surveillance technology has that the UK spy chief is rightly worried about. So it's another odd and inconsistent situation where an individual or an institution that should, and indeed does, know better, identifies one type of risk when it comes to China in a certain industrial sector, like electronic communications, but then completely ignores the same logic and the same rationale when assessing China and strategic risks in a different industrial sector that we happen to call energy. We may end up learning the hard way that that inconsistency can be quite costly. So the last two dots that we made our connections to, they dealt with issues in the energy arena. And of course, these days, all things energy related, they must at some point bleed into that issue of climate change. And whenever you're talking about climate change, the topic of science inevitably will pop up. Constant listeners know what I'm talking about quite well by now because we've discussed it at many points in prior episodes. There's science as it was meant to be, where you've got progress and innovation and technological advancements, and they're being made through a messy but tried and true process of trial and error and challenging and breaking common consensus and intense scientific debate that's ultimately going to be proven or disproven by the scientific method itself. Now, this is the process that's worked for hundreds of years. It brought us the greatest innovations and step change improvements in human quality of life in the history of the world that we've ever seen. It is also a process that was nurtured and catalyzed by things like individual rights and by capitalism, by republican democracies, and by the free market. So that latter list, it fed the former and vice versa, and that created a really virtuous circle of value creation that everybody has been able to enjoy. But, you know, very powerful segments of society, they have a problem with all of this abundance. Sometimes the segments will be religions. Sometimes it will be government and the bureaucrat. Sometimes it will be the establishment, where progress and innovation, they're proving to be a threat to hold on power. And these segments are what we refer to today as the elite class or the expert class. They're the influential few who are entrenched, and they want to speak for the many. And they do so by controlling innovation and by stifling advancements so that they occur how the elite decide and how the experts want them to be paced. That's how science grotesquely morphed into scientific consensus. That's how the scientific method and debate were swiped and replaced with shouts of denier or quack or radical. And that's how the truth was swapped for 90% of scientists agree. And that's how science became the science. And this trend and disturbing theme when it comes to science brings us to our next connection, which falls upon the dot of not climate change or energy, but instead medicine and COVID. We know the great state of California, it's become a hotbed of leftist ideology that embraces these flawed concepts of scientific consensus and, you know, 90% of experts agree and the science. And now California political leaders have focused their attention with these themes, not only in the arena of energy and climate, but they're also applying these destructive mechanisms in the arena of medicine, specifically with COVID or pandemic. Back in late September, the Democratic leadership in California's legislature and governor's office enacted legislation that allows the state medical board, and that's your panel of experts, so to speak, to discipline physicians and doctors who are licensed in the state when they, and I'm going to quote here from the bill, when they disseminate misinformation or disinformation that ends up contradicting, and I'm going to quote again, the contemporary scientific consensus of all things COVID related. Now that quote or paraquotes is quite the conceptual mouthful. So let's unpack them. You have those terms, misinformation and disinformation. When it comes to science or medical research, who gets to decide the subjective criteria of what is misinformation or what constitutes disinformation? Well, in California, it looks like it will be a bureaucrat or a state board of bureaucratic experts. And recognize in the case of medical research or medical cutting-edge tech, or certainly COVID more specifically, that today's misinformation or disinformation, it ends up being tomorrow's truth that enjoys having medical certainty. That's how scientific advancement works. Back in the day of George Washington, a doctor attaching leeches to the body of a sick person to cure ailments was an expert applying the scientific consensus of the day. A medical professional who would have criticized the leech practice would be labeled as a quack or a medical heretic. Lo and behold, what time brought in medical advancements and improved understanding, it proved the heretic to be the truth teller. So goes it with science and innovation and research and technology advancements. And then there is that second part of the quote to unpack, which is, again, contradicting the contemporary scientific consensus. So here you really start to see the danger and the problem with what California is now requiring. First, we see that flaw of the scientific consensus rear its head. Einstein proved it as flawed when his theory of relativity blew up the reigning consensus of the time. The Jurassic Park creator and science fiction author Michael Crichton exposed scientific consensus as a flawed theory in his fiction and in his speeches. And every innovator and inventor that disrupted the status quo with the next discovery or the next technological advancements, they have and will prove it to be wrong once again. So from Newton to Tesla to Jobs, science always was and always will be about challenging and disrupting and blowing up the consensus, and doing so gleefully. And when it comes to science and the medical field, the inability to challenge a consensus and making it effectively a crime to do so inevitably will result in not just the slowing of advancing the state of the art of medical care, but also will result in the loss of countless lives that would have been saved but for the slowing down of progress. Think of it this way, constant listeners. What if we developed and then set in stone our initial scientific consensus when it came to COVID the first month the pandemic was raging? And what if under California law, it became the law of the land that there's no one in the medical community or otherwise who would be allowed to challenge the consensus? What would have happened? Well, countless, but at least numbering in the millions of additional deaths would have occurred by the less than optimal approach to dealing with and managing COVID and the pandemic. You compare that to today, where the next variation of COVID that appears on the scene, we're much better informed and better prepared to manage through it individually for at-risk populations and across societies than we were 2 short years ago. Now, you can call that experience or increased understanding or scientific progress in the field of medicine and pandemic. You pick whichever you choose. But if the contemporary scientific consensus was defended at the start of COVID, and any change or challenge to it was precluded, we would not enjoy the knowledge and the protections and the survival rates that we do when managing COVID today. Yeah, I just don't dislike this recent California law. I frankly despise it, and the reasons are multifaceted. It is clearly first and foremost anti-science, and as an engineer, that bothers me to my professional core. It's going to result in the loss of countless lives and deter advancements to the human condition, to the economy, and to society. Those things are certainly not desirable. It also is constitutionally, I think, suspect when you consider how vague things like misinformation or disinformation or that beast of a phrase, contemporary scientific consensus, just how vague those terms are. And that vagueness in such legislation inevitably suppresses free speech, and it might likely violate the 14th Amendment of the Constitution for vagueness. So if you like science, and you like high quality of life, and you like saving lives, and you like the Constitution, you cannot like this California law. Down with Assembly Bill number 2098. All right, enough with that despicable California Bill number 2098. Let's jump to our next connection. We've been discussing the themes of technology and science and national security in China. I saw something recently. It was an Australian-produced expose that brings together all of these grand points, and the expose dealt with the subject of the potential invasion of Taiwan by China, along with some of the acute and subsequent follow-on effects that it would have on the global economy. Now, I'm not sure if the constant listeners are aware of this, but Taiwan enjoys an outsized impact on global semiconductor supply. In fact, in a very small footprint of land, Taiwan controls a significant part of the global semiconductor production. And if China were to invade the island nation, then the United States is going to face a dilemma. On one hand, the United States could decide to not intervene with, say, damaging or destroying Taiwan's infrastructure, and then have to face the specter of China once it might prevail with its invasion of now controlling the lion's share of global semiconductor production. That would be yet another strategic advantage in another crucial industry that China would enjoy. But on the other hand, if the United States wants to prevent control of the semiconductor supply to fall even more firmly within China's grasp, the U.S. could potentially destroy Taiwan's semiconductor manufacturing facilities prior to China gaining control of them in the island. Now, this Australian expose and the subject of the potential invasion of Taiwan, it did a deep dive on this issue, and I just found it fascinating. The producers interviewed experts in the United States and internationally, and they all opined on how these two options would be weighed, and they all made the point that was a little bit obvious, which was China invading Taiwan and then either gaining control of semiconductor production on the island or the United States destroying that production capacity during invasion. Both of those scenarios would represent really bad outcomes for the global economy in many things across commerce and economies and markets. You know, they would just cease to function. And the expose proceeded to make another salient and logical point, which was that the United States or Western economies investing money into providing resources to Taiwan for its military defense and its capabilities, that was a prudent investment to de-risk or reduce the likelihood of not just a Chinese invasion, but also the possible and subsequent ruining or control of a vital industry. Basically, the logic was invest in Taiwan's defense capabilities, and that's going to reduce the likelihood of an invasion and an economic global catastrophe from occurring. Obviously, a prudent and logical insurance policy, so to speak. Now, here's what's fascinating about all of this. First, of course, is the military tactical aspects of what it would take to invade Taiwan and what that would look like in modern warfare. The second fascinating point, of course, is the logic applied when it came to protecting a vital industry like semiconductors. But the third item that fascinated me was completely missed by the expose and is what I wanted to focus on in this episode of The Far Middle. And that is that the film and the experts interviewed in the film, they made the point that there's a vital industry, which is semiconductors. It needs protected from entities like China, and that the best way to protect that is to invest in things that nurture the ability for that industry to function, in this case, the military capabilities of Taiwan. Let's contrast that to what these same experts in these same types of films are positing when it comes to energy. Like semiconductors, energy is a vital industry for the United States and for the world. In fact, more vital than even semiconductors. Second, China has its eyes on controlling global energy markets through the control of the supply and processing capacity of and for metals and materials and rare earths that are used to make wind turbines and solar panels and electric vehicle batteries, just like it has its eyes fixated on control of the vital semiconductor industry. But then you start to see the logic diverge, because with energy, the experts lectured that we need to move as quickly as possible to reduce or eliminate domestic energy sources like natural gas and replace them as soon as possible with energy sources such as wind and solar and electric vehicles, which must necessarily be manufactured and provided by China. Now, where was the consistent logic to be applied whereby investment in domestic energy like natural gas or pipelines is one of those prudent investments, just like investing in Taiwan's military capabilities that will deter Chinese aggression and or that will improve our ability in the United States to defend our interests and to protect Republican democracy? Why are these experts so eager to surrender a strategic industry like energy to the Chinese when they see the obvious dangers of doing so in the case of semiconductors with Taiwan? Frankly, constant listeners, it makes no sense at all until you realize that all religions, to a certain extent, do not make logical sense. What do you say we close out episode 82? I'm really happy with the ground we covered this time. We hit some major themes, dove deep on some issues facing us in our world. We started the episode dedicating it to the epic bout between Arguello and Pryor in 82. Earlier that year, the Grammys were held in Los Angeles, and the Song of the Year and the Record of the Year both were awarded to Bette Davis Eyes, which of course was sung by Kim Carnes. But the individual who won the most Grammys in 1982 was the incomparable Quincy Jones. He won 5 in total. I love Quincy Jones. He is a great jazz musician and composer and producer and record executive, mind you. I'm still going at just shy of 90 years old, which is hard to believe. The guy's worked with Elvis. He worked with Sinatra. Of course, he worked with Michael Jackson, although it is tough for me to mention Michael Jackson these days. But Quincy Jones, you know, he learned the business of music the hard way. He said, "We had the best jazz band on the planet, and yet we were literally starving. That's when I discovered that there was music and there was the music business. If I were to survive, I would have to learn the difference between the two." Well, Quincy Jones certainly learned the difference between the two. And if you listen to Quincy Jones's jazz work in the 60s and 70s, it's some of the best that you'll ever experience. Best albums from Quincy are Walking in Space and The Dude. Give them a spin or a stream. Settle in and relax till next week of The Far Middle. Bye for now.